It has been 9 days since 150 people died in a German Wings plane crash in the French Alps. Officials believe the crash was the deliberate act of the jetliner's co-pilot after he locked the captain out of the cockpit. News reports from Germany today say the co-pilot, Andreas Lubitz, lied to doctors by telling them he was on sick leave when he was still flying commercial airliners. Lufthansa acknowledged that it knew Lubitz had been treated for severe depression, raising questions about why the airline had allowed him to complete his training and fly passenger jets. A look at mental health and the workplace with Baltimore psychiatrist Mark Comrade. Should people being treated for psychological disorders, including depression, be precluded from certain professions? Do doctors have a responsibility to report impaired patients to employers? That's on Midday. First, the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. It's been 9 days now since a German Wings plane with 150 people on board crashed in the French Alps. Authorities believe that the co-pilot, Andreas Lubitz, deliberately locked the captain out of the cockpit in order to alter the flight's course and take the Airbus down. The plane was traveling from Barcelona to Dusseldorf and included passengers from at least 15 countries, as well as a group of 16 German high school students. While authorities sort through the wreckage, media reports today continue to raise questions about whether Lubitz was fit to fly. Lufthansa, German Wings' parent company, acknowledged that in 2009, 6 years ago, 2009, while rejoining the airline's pilot training program, Lubitz disclosed a previous episode of severe depression. At a press conference, Lufthansa's chief executive stated that Lubitz was, quote, 100% flight-worthy without any limitations, end quote, and that the airline had, quote, no indication what could have led the co-pilot to commit this terrible act, end quote. It's hard to fathom the motives of someone who would not only kill himself but take down a plane full of passengers. The crash has raised questions about whether people being treated for psychological disorders, including depression, should be precluded from certain occupations, and whether doctors have a responsibility to report impaired or at-risk patients to employers. Joining us to sort through these issues is Baltimore psychiatrist Dr. Mark Comrade. Mark Comrade has been on our show before. He is the author of You Need Help, A Step-by-Step Plan to Convince a Loved One to Get Counseling. He's also taught psychiatry at the University of Maryland. He's been a senior supervising faculty at Shepherd Pratt Hospital. And as a clinical instructor, he's at Johns Hopkins Hospital, too. Mark Comrade, nice to have you back on the show with
Thank
us.
Thank you, Dan.
So let's start with a sort of a review of the facts. I just went over the facts of the crash and what's come out since then, at least officially from Lufthansa. There have been there's more information. So what do we know? What do we do? What don't we know, which is of interest to you?
Yeah, it's actually mostly what we don't know. What you didn't add in your description was that when authorities went to Lubitz's home, they discovered a doctor's note. And the doctor's note said something like, you shouldn't be working, and it covered certain dates, including the date of the crash.
Mm-hmm.
We actually don't know what kind of doctor that was, why that note was issued. Somebody knows that, but so far it isn't public knowledge. I mean, was this an ENT doctor who, gave him this excuse because of an ear infection, or was this related to mental health? We really don't know that. We know that there's a history of treatment in the past, but we don't know how far back that goes, that he was treated for a mood disorder, for depression. And there was some information that at some point, and we don't know when, he had had a period of suicidal thinking. We don't know any more whether he ever made any kind of suicide attempts and so forth. And we know that apparently as recently as last summer, he had a routine, I think annual or semi-annual evaluation of both physical and mental health, and was cleared at that time to fly. So there is also some suggestion that he was taking a medication. We actually don't know whether he was on the medication at the time he was flying. That's lorazepam was at least one medicine that's been mentioned, which many people might know by its more familiar name, Ativan.
And Ativan is an antidepressant? Is for it's mood disorders?
No, actually, it's for anxiety. It's
anxiety.
A benzodiazepine. It's really in the same family as Valium or Xanax or Klonopin, other medicines people might recognize.
Is there a risk factor in using that drug?
Well, if used improperly, certainly, that overuse of that class of medications can actually produce some of the same effects that alcohol can, overuse of alcohol. They are potentially addictive, although not in most people, but it certainly is a possibility. You can, in large quantities, yes, it can impair judgment and motor skills and so forth, really very similar to being drunk.
Does that increase the risk of self-harm? Because I've read about this drug, you said lorazepam, which most people know as Ativan.
Right.
There's a reference in here to the from the German press, the daily newspaper in Germany, Bild, saying that according to medical records, Lubitz was taking this medication, but as you say, they don't know when exactly. Mm-hmm. Bild says that medical experts say it can also increase the risk of self-harm at the start of treatment.
Well, what sometimes can happen is that people who have perhaps on the verge of self-destructive behaviors or thoughts, if they become disinhibited by a medication that can reduce your inhibitions, which this potentially alcohol-like effect mm-hmm. that benzodiazepines can have, might early in the course before, say, an antidepressant starts to work, take away the inhibition for self-destruction. But again, that's very, very rare. And actually, most people who often have anxiety as part of the syndrome of depression really benefit from taking those medications on their way to recovery.
Would you say, and because we're going to talk about occupations and mental health, that when we talk about tests or evaluations that this particular co-pilot went through, that pilots have generally a higher standard to meet when it comes to psychological evaluations? The U.S. Airline Pilots Association says that most American pilots undergo medical testing that includes mental and emotional assessment at least once a year by a doctor approved by the Federal Aviation Administration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's unlike many jobs, this idea of a routine and repeated requirement. The interesting thing, though, is that prior to 2010, if you were on any kind of psychiatric medication, no matter what it was for, no matter whether it was helpful or not helpful, side effects or no side effects, you were precluded from flying. So as you might imagine, prior to 2010, a lot of pilots were very underground if they had to be on those medications and treated privately. As of 2010, however, there was actually first an amnesty period where pilots were invited with no consequences to tell if they were on medications. And then only one specific class of medications was approved for pilots to be on if they were going to fly, and that's the so-called serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. So those are medications in the class of Prozac and Zolofts and Celexa and Lexapro, things like that. So that is now one of the approved classes of medications that pilots can take.
Because it's so commonly prescribed for people who so commonly suffer from periods of depression, for instance?
Well, of course, there are a lot of other medications that are very commonly prescribed as well. I'm not sure whether it's common or whether I certainly wasn't party to that decision, but mm-hmm. whether or not it was felt that the risks and the benefit and the balance between those two were particularly favorable for that category of medications.
I wonder what your thoughts are on your observations on the way this story has been reported, what the commentary you've heard, raising questions about whether right. some people should be precluded from certain occupations once they're treated for, say, severe depression.
Yeah.
Would you talk a little bit about
sure.
that, Mark?
You know, I and many mental health professionals and advocacy organizations like the National Alliance of Mentally Ill have been very, very distressed at the way this has been reported and particularly the effects that it's having. You know, we always worry about the stigma associated with mental illness and the stigma associated with its treatment And of course, you and I have talked in the past about the stigma associated with those who treat them against psychiatrists themselves, mm-hmm. typically. So this issue has really brought out what I've called a double-sided stigma, right? On the one hand is the stigma about mental illness and that automatically, necessarily, being an obstacle to being able to work. But on the other hand, it's also brought out a stigma against treatment, that those in treatment might actually be on medications and so forth that could also obstruct their ability to do certain jobs. So sort of darned if you do and darned if you don't, if you get treatment or if you don't get treatment, kind of a lose-lose situation. The other thing also that is very distressing is that, as often happens in these cases of heinous behavior, the public often results as kind of a wastebasket to equate dreadful and heinous behavior necessarily with mental illness. And those two are not identical. Mental illness is sometimes a catch-all, a wastebasket. Really, the only thing that heinous behaviors have in common with typical mental illnesses is that they sometimes appear to be irrational but are certainly undesirable. And not all irrational, undesirable human behavior really has, do we understand, as one of the canonical ways that the human mind can go wrong that we call mental illness or mental disorders. And I will tell you that most psychiatrists really are not able to grapple with this kind of behavior. We don't understand that. It's not within the domain of our familiarity. You know, to even call suicide.
I mean, this is a kind of extreme behavior, suicide or mass murder.
Mass murder in particular.
Yeah.
Right? So I mean, suicide is something that we are very familiar with. But mass murder, or sort of the murder-suicide scenario, is something, first of all, it's extremely rare. So scientifically, it's very difficult to study. Secondly, it really isn't part of the typical phenomena that we see in the course of the standard things that walk into our offices, depression and schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, anxiety, and so forth.
I have a question about that then. Let's just talk about that, mm-hmm. the standard things that walk into your office, mm-hmm. symptoms and problems people have. How many of them are work-related? I mean, I don't just mean in your own experience, but maybe it's difficult for you to speak in general terms about this, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure how all this works. I know that there are employee assistance programs mm-hmm. at companies, right? You have human resources. Mm-hmm. And if you're unable to function, if you're at the point where some depression or some anxiety is making it impossible for you to do your work mm-hmm. satisfactorily, a humane organization will send you off for an evaluation, get you some help through an employee assistance program, right? So they may end up in your mm-hmm. office or the office of another psychiatrist or psychologist. Mm-hmm. Is that right? I mean, does this happen?
Sure.
That's what
of course it does.
It does.
As a matter of fact, the American with Disabilities Act even permits employers who have a reasonable suspicion that there are psychological problems that are affecting job performance to ask an employee to get an evaluation.
Ah, okay.
But one of the things we need to distinguish.
Excuse me. Is there any risk in that for the employer? Since we're going to talk about employers today, when they the law is on their side, it sounds like.
Well, no, not. It depends on what you mean on their side.
I mean, the employer. I just wonder, if you ask somebody to get evaluated, are you, the employer, so worried that you could be held liable, you'd be sued for discrimination or something, for even mm-hmm. suggesting an evaluation?
Well, let's be clear. The American with Disabilities Act, first of all, does not allow an employer to ask upfront on an application, do you have any kind of a medical condition? However, after an offer is made, an employer then does have the right to ask people to get a medical or a psychiatric exam, but it has to ask it of every single person who is in that line of job. It can't single out a single person. Then once you're on the job, if you begin to have problems on the job, then the employer is empowered to say, we'd like to have an evaluation. And it's very important to note that the evaluation and the treatment are something that we really understand the importance of keeping separate. So we talk about an employee assistance program. That's really a treatment program that many employers have for their employees. However, a fitness for duty evaluation is something different. As a matter of fact, it's an emerging specialty in psychiatry of occupational psychiatry that specializes in this. Sometimes forensic psychiatrists cover this. And that is to have a separate individual who's not a treating mental health professional of that person, because after all, we form relationships with people. We tend to lean into a certain advocacy stance It's only human nature to be protective of one's patients. So you really actually don't want to rely on a treating mental health professional to do an assessment. Just like a disability evaluation, you get an independent person. And a fitness for duty evaluation involves actually garnering a variety of data, not just interviewing the patient and taking their history. It may involve calling a primary care doctor for additional information. It may involve employee records, personnel files, interviewing HR people, possibly even interviewing the boss, the supervisor, and the employer. So all of that is opened to the evaluator.
What kind of occupations are we talking about? It sounds like a higher standard, fitness for duty, mm-hmm. versus just an evaluation.
Well, I think there are two places this tends to come up. One, which is in any jobs that involve public safety, driving, professional drivers, law enforcement, pilots, and so forth. And the other is high-level professionals, where the company may have a lot at stake and want to, you know, protect their interests to make sure that this executive isn't, going to do something adverse to the company's interests.
So in that case, the way that's established and structured, the doctor, psychiatrist, reports to the employer, correct?
Right. And it's understood. Patient gives permission up front, and everything is open. So the problem with maybe this scenario, I don't know, we're guessing, but the interesting thing that this scenario brings up is, let's say I have a patient in treatment. Let's say that patient is a pilot. Let's say that at the time of our last session, I have some significant concerns about whether this person should be flying, right? What is my obligation? What is my duty to the patient as well as my duty to society? So this really brings us to a very fundamental concept that I think we have to stop to talk about here, which is the concept of confidentiality.
Well, we'll take a break and do that after this short announcement from WYPR. Dr. Mark Comrade, Baltimore psychiatrist, our guest in this hour of midday. You're welcome to join us with comments or questions. We're talking about the German wing's co-pilot and this story from the French Alps last week, this tragedy. 410-662-8780 is how to reach us locally. Toll-free, long-distance, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. And you can send comments or questions by email, midday@wypr.org. Some perspective from one of our listeners, Pamela, who wrote in, Dr. Comrade, Mark Comrade, our guest here in this hour of midday. There are almost 100,000 flights worldwide each day and millions each year. Occasionally, bad things will happen in the course of daily life, a crash or a terrorist act. Occasionally, in the course of a year, on an Earth with 6 billion plus people, one person will visit tragedy in other people's lives. One corporation or doctor might miss a clue or a note or a piece of paper, and this will continue to happen owing to our imperfect humanity. The first reaction from a risk-phobic culture is to find a remedy for the tragedy, singular and rare though it may be, and this reaction leads, as night follows day, to overreactions that in some cases only create new forms of discrimination and stigma. In this case, the stigma will be against depressed people. Tragedy happens, Pamela writes. The attempt to fix the problem can lead to greater folly and discrimination. One response to this tragedy is to show proportion and equanimity. One reaction is to embrace the reality that in a free and mobile society, not all sources of destructive behavior can or should be eradicated.
I love that. I agree with that in every significant way.
Yeah, we don't
way.
Need to go on, do we?
that's
very good, Pamela.
You know, I think it takes me back to the Newtown massacre, right? Where suddenly there was a rush to try to change all sorts of things, and in New York they passed this law that required mental health professionals to change the standards by which they would break the confidentiality of their patients to a much looser standard than had been before, without really a time to thoughtfully examine what were the fundamental underlying values on which the system is based. And I think that being reflective about what those values are, you know, Pamela's right. As Thomas Sowell famously said, there are no solutions in life. There are only trade-offs.
Hmm.
And we gain a lot by the system that we have. It's kind of like the legal system, right, which is designed to make sure that
it's about balancing, right?
That innocent people aren't punished.
Yeah.
Sometimes can be just as important, if not more important, than the idea that the guilty should be punished. So it's kind of the same thing here, which brings us to the fundamental issue that we left off with, which is confidentiality.
Yes.
So confidentiality is important in all of medicine, and of course HIPAA, it's a very fundamental concept around which HIPAA is based. Most people are familiar with that. But nowhere is it more important than in mental health. I call confidentiality in mental health the sterile field, kind of like in surgery. You know, in surgery, you can do an operation, but if you don't have sterile field, things are probably likely to either go wrong or certainly not work and
infection.
Not be optimum. That's
yeah.
right. Whereas, and in psychiatry, by the same token, confidentiality is extraordinarily important for things to have their optimal outcome when doing this kind of incredibly sensitive work. Confidentiality, first of all, invites people in. Without the promise of a certain degree of confidentiality, and in mental health, as law actually would have it, a higher degree of confidentiality than in other fields, people are going to be reluctant to come in. That to disclose the vulnerable, sensitive, potentially dangerous disclosures that have to come out if you're going to have effective mental health treatment really requires some guarantees, some bunker to protect you against the consequences of those disclosures. So this issue here really gets us at a very root concept, which is how confidential are you in a treatment relationship that involves an employer? And I will tell you that we are really the jealous champions as much as possible with our patients' confidentiality up until a point. Now, we have a long tradition in psychiatry in particular of a threshold, and that threshold is dangerousness, right? Something very hard to predict, actually. Something it turns out we're not very good of, certainly in the long run. In the short run, we're better. I might be able to predict what somebody's going to be dangerous today or, you know, through tomorrow. I'm not very good. None of us are very good at predicting whether they're going to be dangerous 3 days from now or 5 days from now. So the
dangerous to themselves and others.
Or others.
Right, right.
Dangerous either outwards or inwards.
Mm.
So that the delicacy of this is really important, because if the danger is not imminent, if I can't to a high degree of confidence predict danger, I need to guard that confidentiality of the patient. And the law requires it, and my ethics require it.
Okay, but in the situation where a fit for duty evaluation, for instance,
okay.
of a pilot or a co-pilot.
Okay.
I understand it's different. So, but even then, okay, so maybe the confidentiality is not the issue there, but your evaluation, your judgment is, right?
Yes.
So in the case of a pilot of an airplane, you're conducting an you work for the Federal Aviation Administration on a contract, and you see pilots that fly out of BWI.
Right.
And you evaluate them, and then there's one in that bunch that you evaluated, and you thought you're troubled by it, right? So you make some notes. You're very concerned about some of the things that the pilot said and some of his behavior, and you have to make a judgment about how and when and what you report to that airline that employs that pilot.
But you see, right? If I'm a fitness for duty evaluator, my level of confidentiality is more relaxed, right? Because I've been asked, and the patient has actually given
permission. No, I understand. I get
right?
that. But what I'm saying is that your judgment right. then is whether to report that this is a potentially dangerous right. person who probably shouldn't be flying this airplane.
And I've got to be able to use that judgment. And the fact is that the interesting thing is we are more likely to be to have false positives than false negatives. In other words, we're more likely to report people that are dangerous who turn out not to be. Than the other way around. And maybe that's the way it should be, right? Maybe we should err on that side. But studies really have shown that the vast majority of people that are predicted to be dangerous don't go on to be dangerous, maybe partially because they're getting an intervention.
Okay, let me ask you this, Dr. Conrad. I like to call you Mark, too. I call you Mark. I call you Dr.
It's
Conrad.
Fine.
Yesterday, Irv Yalom was on the show. I called him Dr. Yalom. I call him Irv.
One of my intellectual heroes.
I know. So you're making your evaluation, and maybe you don't say that the person you find the person to be, this pilot, to be dangerous. But you think, well, obviously he's having periods of depression. I'm going to prescribe some medication for him. Does that go to the airline? Does the airline know that?
Yeah. And I think that if
they you're, do, they do
yeah,
know that.
If you're a fitness for duty doc, you need to report that. But, you know, one of the problems is this, Dan. A lot of psychiatric conditions, sometimes, particularly those that come on and relapse and remit, can come on quickly, can come on very, very quickly. That you can be well today and suicidal tomorrow. Or you can, you know, give reassurances to me today that you're really okay, that you're not feeling suicidal. And by the time you get home, you can be suicidal. You can also lie to me, too.
What do you do?
Because I can't read your mind.
But to Pamela's point, you know, about depressed people, right? She used the word depressed in quotes here. Stigma will be against depressed people. You report that this pilot has had periods of depression. Mm-hmm. So what?
Yeah,
a lot of people who are depressed function in society and function in their jobs.
As a matter of fact, the smallest minority of people, untreated depression, 15% of people will attempt suicide. Once depression is treated, that number goes radically down. The number of people that commit violence as a result of depression are vanishingly small. Mass murder. I mean, look, it was a fascinating study back last year. In the Journal of Law and Human Behavior, they looked at 143 offenders who had violent offenders who had a diagnosis of some major mental illness. And they asked the question, for how many of those people could the violent behaviors be directly attributed to the illness, as opposed to the usual things that drive anybody who doesn't have a mental illness to violence: anger, frustration, passion, greed, jealousy, mm-hmm. and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I guess seven deadly sins,
right?
And they discovered that you could only make a case for the direct linkage between the illness and the violent behavior in 3 to 10% of the people. So in less than 10% of the people. So what would be an example? An example might be somebody who has a psychosis, who hears voices, and the voices are telling them that they need to save the world by killing that security guard over there. Okay, that would be an example of a violent behavior that is linked to the illness itself. Okay, but someone with schizophrenia could just as easily walk in on their wife having an affair with another man and commit a violent act just as easily as somebody without a psychiatric disorder. So the attribution, so you may have a violent act, you may have a mental illness. Those both may be true, but they may not necessarily be related. And there's a temptation to say, well, if somebody has some kind of a condition and they misbehave, it must be due to that condition. So even if somebody is being treated by me, and even if I say, look, I don't think this person is likely to misbehave by virtue of their mental illness, they could still misbehave for the reasons that any of us could misbehave. So again, my ability to predict this is really very modest.
Dr. Mark Conrad, our guest in this hour of Midday. You can join our conversation if you wish, 410-662-8780. You heard me at the outset of the show mentioning Andres Lubitz, the co-pilot, and what Lufthansa, his employer, acknowledged knowing that they were aware of this co-pilot's history of depression from 2009, I think. That information's at least 6 years old, as I mentioned. Now, how useful could that have been today in determining his fitness to fly?
Yeah. There's only one piece of past history that's of any use in determining the future in psychiatry, and that is the history of having engaged in a certain behavior. So a past history of a suicide attempt, those who've had a suicide attempt before are predictably much more likely to have another one.
And we don't see that in the Lubitz case yet, anyway, as far as the information that we have.
Right. Well, we were told, though, that he was treated for suicidal thoughts, but
tendencies.
Not necessarily for suicidal behavior.
Yeah.
There are other things that can increase our suspicion and our concern of risk. Certainly, if you're having symptoms such as hearing voices telling you to misbehave, that's a fairly good predictor. Substance abuse, so drinking on top of depression or drinking on top of hallucinations, definitely increases your risk of behaving dangerously or violently. There are a variety of other factors we can go down the risk that create sort of a statistical cloud that may cause us in the context of doing a suicide assessment to be able to reach a conclusion that leans us in the direction that this is a person at risk. And by the way, we do that all the time in practice and periodically. You know, I have a patient who, going through that assessment, I determine they can't go home. They need to go to the hospital. And sometimes, rarely, but if necessary, I have the ability to do this, and I've done this before, I may need to send that patient to the hospital against his or her will, mobilizing the authorities to make sure they get there.
I want to ask you one more question about confidentiality here, a different scenario. So you're not doing a fitness for duty evaluation. You're just seeing a patient, right, who's come to you because he or she is depressed. And this person, let's say this person is in the realm of public safety, occupied that way in their occupation. And you're concerned, right? You're seeing some troubling signs here that may lead you to think the person is a danger. I mean, what do you do then?
So there are ways of approaching this without necessarily breaking the patient's confidentiality and calling up, you know, his shift supervisor directly. So particularly with patients who are involved in jobs of public safety, it's very important for whatever mental health professional is involved in treating to have an alliance with someone in the family. And very often what I will do is I will bring in a family member that we've already had a connection that I've previously established to share my concerns. Now, the family member has no obligation for confidentiality. So I include the family member in trying to help work this out, maybe help convince the person that they need to report in to their employer, maybe indeed to call the employer him or herself.
Just a quick question there. So is that alliance with a family member that's done with the consent of the patient?
Yeah, and that's why I try to establish that early on in the treatment
If
I'm dealing with somebody who's involved with public safety. Certainly, if I feel there's an imminent problem, I can always hospitalize, whether it's voluntary or involuntary. And then there can sometimes be a call in which, in certain circumstances, under some extreme conditions, I may actually end up having to call the employer. And there are actually some legal loopholes that allow me to do that. Fascinating thing I just learned in Germany, it's different than the United States. If a doctor does something like that and breaks the patient's confidentiality, and later on that decision is questioned and found not to be justified, unlike America, that doctor can go to jail for up to 5 years.
Wow.
In the U.S., it's just a civil matter. In Germany, it's a criminal matter, which may be
part of what the story might be.
There may
be a dynamic in this story the Lubitz story and German Wings.
I was really surprised to learn that.
We're going to talk some more with Dr. Mark Comrade when we get back about this. How do you feel about it? Do you have any questions? 410-662-8780. If an employer knows about a problem like this, what do you think the employer should do? Are you worried that there'll be more discrimination in the future toward, I know Dr. Comrade is now because of this story. Pamela's point in her email suggests that we may be concerned that employers may be setting a higher threshold for continued employment for people who have been diagnosed with depression.
I am concerned.
It becomes their, 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. What do you think employers should do in situations like this? And should these confidentialities be kept? Do you think there should be a higher standard for pilots, police officers, people in the military in terms of psychological evaluations? 410-662-8780. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, Dr. Mark Comrade, my guest in this hour of the show, psychiatrist and author of You Need Help, A Step-by-Step Plan to Convince a Loved One to Get Counseling. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. We'll go back to our conversation with Dr. Conrad. In a moment, I just want to report some news. The Baltimore Sun reporting that Heather Cook, the Episcopal bishop, charged with driving under the influence and fatally striking a bicyclist, Thomas Palermo, in North Baltimore in December, effectively entered a not guilty plea today by accepting a June trial date. Just reading from BaltimoreSun.com, with five members of the extended family of Mr. Palermo present, Cook and her attorneys accepted a June trial date, her first public appearance since the accident. Cook made no public comment at the city's circuit court. She's charged with manslaughter for allegedly driving drunk and sending text messages when she struck and killed Mr. Palermo 2 days after Christmas, a story that we covered and talked about here on Midday a lot, that's been actually made some international news because of Heather Cook's stature as an Episcopal bishop. And also came to mind today as we were preparing for this show today, because of the questions that were raised about what her employer, the leaders of the diocese, the Episcopal Diocese of Maryland, knew about her drinking problems previously and when they knew about them. And these questions have come up repeatedly. Even if they knew about those problems, what should they have done? Should they have denied her the status of bishop suffragan? Should it have precluded her from career advancement? So I thought it was a similar question when if my employer at the Baltimore Sun found out that I was arrested for drunk driving. I'm sure it would be in the newspaper. But, you know, the humane thing to do would be to get me some help, not fire me on the spot, hopefully. And then what? Does that impair my ability to be a newspaper columnist, to write, opinion pieces for the Baltimore Sun? Does that employer have a right to say, you've lost your opportunity here? It raises lots of questions in my mind. In the case of Heather Cook, there's all these second guessing about whether she should have been elevated or not, whether the leaders of the church should have been more out front about her previous problems to those who were voting for her elevation.
I'll tell you something very interesting, though. We have something called the American with Disabilities Act.
Act, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That says that people who have medical or certain psychiatric disabilities, you can't automatically fire them. There needs to be an opportunity to see if reasonable accommodations can be made.
And that goes for alcoholism?
No. So the fascinating thing is that the Congress specifically spelled out which conditions do not qualify as, quote, disabilities, as the D of the ADA Act. And one of them is substance abuse. Substance abuse does not qualify as an excused disability that allows you to find reasonable
accommodations. I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, I should know this.
It's really incredible.
That is incredible.
I did not know that until this week when I've done research for this show.
People who are alcoholics, who are addicted to heroin, and that's not considered a disability, that doesn't fall under the ADA.
Right. Right.
Wow.
Just like, you know, substance abuse has a completely different level of standards in court when it comes to pleading the insanity defense, right? That substance abuse is generally not at the same level of excusability when it comes to behavior that is eligible for not guilty by reason
of
insanity.
Okay, so I'm not protected under the law, right? Is what you're saying. But when it comes to what I keep referring to here as the humane workplace, right? In a world of second chances and understanding that people have problems, they can be momentary problems, one-time problems, they can be long-term problems. I don't know if the thing to do is to fire someone from their occupation.
Right. And, of course, there's so many forces leading into that, not just traditional stigma and attitudes about psychiatric disorders, but there's also employers' worries about liability, employers' worries about profitability, employers' worries about image and PR.
Yeah.
And all of these things may contribute to a less compassionate response in the workplace.
You know, just before we took the break, I asked the audience whether they thought, they were worried about people being more stigmatized because of the German Wings incident, just people who are diagnosed with depression. And I say just, like, I don't mean to diminish it as a problem, but it's not like schizophrenia or more extreme behavior. So I'm wondering, when we have these extreme examples of violence, in this case, mass murder-suicide, I think you call it, or a mass murder involving guns. We have these high-profile cases. Does psychiatry, psychiatry is under the spotlight. Mm-hmm. It's under the microscope, and people are saying, listen, we need more information. Now, you can't keep this from us. Confidentiality, yeah, we understand it, up to a point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we in psychiatry, as you know, the parade of heinousness continues of mass murderers and shooters and Aurora mm-hmm. and Newtown and so forth, have increasingly come under pressure from society, from legislatures and so forth, to give when it comes to confidentiality. And I will tell you that the response among mental health professionals has sort of been somewhat reactive to that, saying, look, you know, we are the champions of confidentiality because that is something that is so important. Look, you want people to
get
help.
The jealous champions, you said.
Right, the jealous mm-hmm. champions, mm-hmm. the vanguard. You know, my book, You Need Help, right? A step-by-step plan to convince a loved one to get counseling. So how do we get people into help? How do you convince somebody who's clearly more troubled than you know how to deal with to get a state-of-the-art professional evaluation? Well, there have to be certain guarantees and understandings. And as we said earlier, confidentiality is one of those critical guarantees because without that, you know, there's no ball game, you know, let alone game over.
Well, is that pressure there? To loosen up, so to speak.
You bet.
Is there?
Absolutely. Now, you know, sometimes it depends on what the particular context is. So, for example, sometimes what's guarding the confidentiality is not the psychiatrist, but is the law. So, for example, the involuntary commitment laws sometimes are really way too stringent. So that somebody who is clearly, profoundly ill, but doesn't quite meet the legal criteria for involuntary treatment, gets let go in the emergency room, not because the doctor wants to let that person go, but because plenty of experience with hearings and judges and involuntary commitment hearings have shown that this particular person is just not dangerous enough or imminently dangerous enough. And this is a complaint that I've certainly sent a lot of patients to the emergency room with the hopes and expectations that they'll be hospitalized, even involuntarily if necessary, and the ER doc has let them go. And that's been the bane of many a family and one of the very common talking points among people in the National Alliance of Mentally Ill.
So what do you think ought to happen there? What needs to happen there?
Well, I think that, you know, in many states have adopted, Maryland doesn't have this language, an additional standard, which is the concept of gravely ill, right? So not imminently dangerous, but gravely ill. You know, a diabetic who, you know, just isn't feeding themselves properly and is in danger of mm-hmm. having their blood sugar go through the roof, for example. So now, allegedly, it's built into the standards in Maryland that it could be interpreted as gravely ill. Judges are not entirely always cooperating with that connotation. But many states have that explicit language. There have been attempts to get that language into the Maryland legislature that have not been successful. I personally am very supportive of making that language explicit.
Here's another email on this subject for Dr. Comrade, Mark Comrade, our guest in this hour of midday, from Stephanie, who says, unfortunately, you lose a ton when you lose stable full-time work. Most people cannot afford unpaid leave or whatever might get triggered by a psychological evaluation. There needs to be a safe way for workers to honestly address health and psychological concerns. I would lose my job if I said I was depressed. My consulting company would just suspend me or lay me off. It's not worth it for them to try to help me or wait for me to get over it. I'm a federal contractor. I wonder why she says that, why she believes that she would be suspended or laid. I mean, she just couldn't do her work. Maybe
it's the culture of her particular environment.
Okay.
I mean, my experience, there are some employers that are more compassionate about this than others. There are some employers that provide, as we talked about before, an employee assistance program, mm-hmm. a stopgap measure where you don't have to let somebody go who's having problems, but you can actually try to remediate and ameliorate. So some more enlightened employers than others. But I really also want to add here that we have an aspiration.
What's our aspiration?
Culture, right?
What is it?
Right. So our aspiration is that all human suffering is potentially treatable.
And predictable?
And predictable.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's just not so. And I think that that employers sometimes may aspire to that, and others may be very skeptical about that.
I'm thinking of Lufthansa now, the airline that's going to be subject to quite a lots of lawsuits here, potentially. There's speculation about that in the press already, the financial liability. So that could certainly contribute to higher thresholds in terms of evaluations of pilots in the future.
Right. I mean, presumably,
who you accept, who you leave on the job, who you train. Right.
You know, this is still an extraordinarily rare event. You know, so the question is, if one big meteor hits a small town, right, does that mean it's worth $5 trillion to create a whole meteor shield around the planet Earth? Right. So there's kind of a risk assessment. We tend to have a logical fallacy of overestimating risk when, you know, a particularly emotional example is in our face.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I have this happen all the time when there's a plane crash and it causes a number of my patients to kind of go over the threshold of fear of flying. Even though, you know, it's the first class crash in the last, you know, 500 million passenger miles.
It is extraordinary. I think that the Pilots Association mentioned that they do have cases of pilot suicide, but usually a single aircraft, small aircraft, single pilot.
Yeah, that's right. That's the typical scenario.
What's extraordinary about this is the circumstance involving an Airbus with 149 passengers.
Well, there's also something else.
150, excuse me.
Right. It's different than some of the other mass killings that we've seen in the news. I think that this particular example is one in which somebody in whom you have put your trust and vulnerability in life, you know, you sit back and you relax and you just expect the pilot to be able to take care of you.
Yeah.
For a pilot to deliberately vandalize that trust, it's kind of analogous to, and these people do exist, you know, the rare nurse in the intensive care unit who's a serial killer, right, who's going around knocking off the patients under his or her care. I mean, there actually are documented examples of that. Somebody with whom you put the ultimate vulnerability in and trust, a surgeon who has deliberately violated that trust and done the very opposite of caretaking.
Mark, one last thing. On the report, the report in the media about suicidal tendencies in the case of Lubitz,
mm-hmm.
What do we know about that?
I don't know. And I'm not even sure what the term means. I will tell you that suicidal tendencies is not a clinical term.
Mm-hmm.
It's not one that clinicians use.
People talk about
past history of suicide,
yeah,
or intermittent suicidal ideations or suicidal behavior. I'm not even sure what suicidal tendencies mean.
Well, would you be surprised if a therapist came forward and said, you know, I treated Lubitz for depression and there was no way to see, I didn't see suicide in this picture.
Yeah, I would not be surprised. But again, I just want to say, just because we don't see it doesn't mean that it's there. I mean, we psychiatrists are not mind readers. Patients have to tell us what's going on inside. We have to read between the lines. And also, what may be true at 1 o'clock in the afternoon may no longer be true at 11 o'clock that night.
Baltimore psychiatrist Mark Comrade has been our guest in this hour of Midday. Again, his book, You Need Help, A Step-by-Step Plan to Convince a Loved One to Get Counseling. You can find a link to his website and his Facebook page on my Facebook page. Thanks very much for being here again.
Thank you
very much, Dr. Comrade. Appreciate this. Yeah, appreciate the information. Thursday's lunch provided by Eddie's of Roland Park, offering catering, gourmet sandwiches, personal shopping, and more at its two stores on Roland Avenue and North Charles Street. Eddie'sofRolandPark.com for directions and menus. Thanks very much for delivering lunch today. Thank you, everybody. See you again soon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Marjorie Goodman, Aaron Morenzi, and Mary Troutman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.